Hello and welcome back to the podcast that is always up to speed with Formula One. Mark and Mark, Daly and Hamilton, Thing One and Thing Two, here to talk about what we love to talk about on Thursday nights, and that's Formula One. Today is March 13th, 2021. Can you believe it? I can't believe that we're halfway through. Sorry, did I say March? I meant May. I mean, that just goes to show you that I'm completely out of sync with how fast this year is progressing. I mean, this week went absolutely so quick. I mean, it only seems like, you know, like yesterday or 2 days ago when we sat down to do the Spanish Grand Prix recap show. And here we are, another weekend's upon us. Alas, no Formula One, but we'll make it work. We'll persevere and we can push through to another weekend. But how are you doing, sir?
I'm doing fantastic. And you know, it's crazy. I was lucky enough to get my first vaccine a couple of weeks ago. And it was something I wasn't probably expecting until probably June or July. And you know what? That lifted my spirits and emotionally, it put me in a whole new state. And then the good news is so many of the people that I know in BC and British Columbia and the greater Vancouver area started getting their vaccines this week. So it feels more than ever that there's some light at the end of the tunnel, which is fantastic. And I think what's going to be really exciting if you're a Formula One fan is if you live in a country or near a circuit that hosts a race in the back half of this year, there's a very real possibility that you might be able to attend a race in person. And I think for those of us that maybe don't have that opportunity, watching an F1 race when there are tens or 100,000 people in attendance is a much greater spectacle than it is watching a race when those grandstands are empty. To me, empty grandstands are preseason testing, no matter how great the action is on the track. So I can't wait till our listeners have the opportunity to get back to races. And I can't wait till we can see the races with those packed grandstands, with people waving the flags of their favorite teams, with their banners, with the barbecue happening, with the fireworks, all of that spectacle. I cannot wait. And I think what's exciting for me potentially is, and I keep looking at that date on the calendar, which is, you know what, Montreal is obviously not happening this year, which is really sad for a lot of reasons. It's the right thing by Formula One standards, but I keep looking at that calendar and I look at October and I look at Austin, and you know, we've got some of our listeners that are going to COTA, that are going to Circuit of the Americas, and I keep thinking like, is that a possibility? And you know, it's like June, July, August, September, 5 months out, like maybe that's something that could happen for us this year. So I keep looking at that in the future, but I think emotionally I'm in a pretty good place, man. Thanks for asking. And you're right, there's no race weekend this year, but that doesn't mean there isn't a lot to talk about.
Well, exactly. What also makes me feel good is mailbag. And again, the listeners have stepped up, had some wonderful messages and comments and just tweets and everything. So I just want to dive right into it. First emails from Ricardo Borges. I hope I'm pronouncing that. Checking in from Portugal. I have to admit that when I saw this, I did a double take because I saw Ricardo. I thought Ricciardo, if you kind of like, you know, pronounced the long way, Daniel Ricciardo. So, I mean, still excited we got the email. It's just I did a double take. I'm like, oh, okay, that would have been pretty epic if we had an email from Daniel
way
Ricciardo.
Way too highly of us that F1 drivers are emailing our Gmail account. But go on.
Yeah, exactly. Anyways, Ricciardo has a couple of things he weighed in. He weighed in on Mazepin, Monaco. But the one point that he raised, and I wanted to get your opinions on this, is regarding Yuki Tsunoda. So, anyways, he has to say, where's the Japanese driver at this stage? After a very promising preseason, he is lacking to live up to expectation with struggles with the car, crash in Imola, DNF in Spain, and that episode with the pit box where some bad things were said. Did we put the bar too high, or is he letting the pressure get to him? That's a really good question. I think, obviously, he had an outstanding debut at Bahrain. And then the second race in Imola, that was pretty tricky. I mean, what with everybody having adventures off the track? I mean, even Lewis ended up in the gravel and somehow managed to keep his car mobile enough to pull himself out and rejoin the race. I mean, that was pretty amazing. But yeah, I think that Yuki has had some struggles the past couple of races. And I don't know, maybe we have put the bar a little bit too high based on what we saw in the very first race of the season, but I'm interested to hear what you think about the young driver from Japan.
I think it's a fantastic question, and I think the real challenge for him was his debut performance was so solid. For him to finish in the points in his first contest, and realistically, it's a car that's capable of being in the points, but you don't necessarily expect a rookie pilot to bring kind of a backmarker B team into the points in your first effort. I'm not worried. I think that making that transition from Formula 2 and from Formula 2, because he finished third in the Formula 2 championship last year, is, I think it's a monumental effort. And I think we've heard a lot of analysts in the past talk about the fact that it's not necessarily the straight line speed of the Formula 1 cars that are a struggle for drivers to adapt to, but rather it's the mechanical grip and the forces in the corner and learning the tires that proves to be the most challenging piece. And I think it's not something that you can develop a sense of in the simulator. It's not something that you can develop a sense of and improve by talking with your engineers and the mechanics and all those kind of pieces. Like, you literally just need to have as many reps in this car as possible to become familiar with the tires, to become familiar with how the rate of degradation works, to understand the mechanical grip, to understand how the car works and the chassis works in different conditions, all those kind of pieces. And at the end of the day, I think a rookie driver like Yuki was really... he was put in a bad position because he entered the sport in a year when they shifted to 3 days of winter testing. He, as much as anyone, could have benefited from 4 days, 6 days, 8 days. Like, those additional days would have been monumentally important for his development, because going from Formula 2 to Formula 1 is a monumental step. No matter how talented you are, I'm not worried. I think ultimately... He's not a disaster. He's got a points finish. The confidence is there. I'm also very happy with the fact that he's demonstrating that there's some alpha characteristics to his personality, which I don't think I expected to be there. I think some of his swear words and some of the lashing, I like to see that in the driver a little bit. He's frustrated. He's angry. He's emotional. Those are good things. I'm not worried. I'm not worried at all. And I think by the midpoint in the season, he'll be regularly contending to be back in the points. And again, you look at Lance Stroll's start in Formula One, and it's slightly different because he made the jump from Formula 3 to Formula 1. He skipped the Formula 2 step, but early on, his biggest struggles were learning the tires, learning the grip, learning the mechanical characteristics of grip and cornering these cars. I think he's going to be fine. I'm not super worried, but I think it's a great question. Yeah. What about you?
Yeah, I don't have very much to add to that. The one thing that you brought up, which I thought was really interesting, I was going to bring this up later in the show because I wanted to talk about Sergio Perez, who addressed this specifically, was just the lack of testing. And I was just thinking, well, who does this compressed testing schedule now affect the most? It affects the young rookie drivers coming in into the sport, and also the drivers that are switching teams. So if you're staying put, you probably have less to worry about going from 1 year to another. So you have a young driver like Yuki, who's coming fresh into Formula One. He's got everything to learn, everything that it's new to him, basically. And he only has a couple of days to learn it all before you go to the first race. And I think that's another factor, like you so rightly pointed out. And that is, it really is becoming an issue. And we'll talk about what Sergio had to say a little bit later in the show. But
hey, and one point on that, because you just triggered something in my mind that I think is pretty critical. One, a lot of the drivers and the teams weren't happy with 3 days of winter testing this year. And again, they all agreed to it. Like, they all agreed to 3 days of winter testing. And
absolutely.
They ultimately realized that there's some real knock-on effects to that. But I think next winter, I will be very curious to see how much testing they get, especially as they're moving to that 2022 spec car, which is going to be fundamentally different than what they have this year. Because again, the 2021 cars are very, very similar to the 2020 cars. And to your point, and I'd never thought about this, those that really were impacted by the limited winter testing schedule were the rookies that weren't driving these cars last year and the drivers that were in the Formula One championship but were in a different car. So I think it'll be interesting to see if the teams are able to rally Formula One and the FIA and Liberty about expanding winter testing next year, because I think 3 days was too much. And again, for those of you that are listening, winter testing is usually a period. In the past, it's been as much as basically 2 weeks of testing and shakedown. So the teams, they go to a remote location, typically Barcelona or Bahrain or somewhere like that, and they basically have 2 weeks to run the cars and do shakedowns and do testing, help the drivers get familiar with the new chassis, with new tires, all that kind of stuff. But this year, as a cost-cutting measure, they only did 3 days of winter testing. So each driver only had three sessions in that car before they went off to the first race weekend. So if you're wondering what we're talking about, that just provides a little bit of background and context.
Well, you look at some of the drivers that we've said have been struggling so far out of the gate. Sergio Perez is one. Sebastian Vettel is one. Yuki Tsunoda is another one. Nikita Mazepin, Mick Schumacher to an extent. These are all new drivers in Formula One this year, or guys that have switched teams. So it's certainly had a big effect. Passion, drive, and patience. The formula for winning championships is also what keeps your ride or die alive. eBay Motors has everything you need to maintain your vehicle and level it up to peak performance. Superchargers, roof racks, exhaust kits, LED headlights, and more. Whether you're into speed, power, or style, eBay Motors has you covered. With over 122 million parts for your number one ride or die, you'll always find exactly what you're looking for. And with eBay Guaranteed Fit, your part is guaranteed to fit your ride every time or your money back. Because with eBay Motors, you're burning rubber, not cash. With all the parts you need at the prices you want, it's easy to make your car the MVP and bring home huge wins. Keep your ride or die alive at ebaymotors.com. Eligible items only. Exclusions apply. Okay, next email comes from Richard LeBlanc. I think Richard is in Toronto, if I remember correctly. Anyways, this is a wonderful and massive email full of wonderfully thought out and written questions and comments. So we have three choices here because literally, you know, Richard, just an FYI, this is basically a show outline that we could talk about this all three points at length here. So I'm gonna let you choose and then I'll read it out. So topic number one is what he calls ham goats. Number two, yeah. Number two is the real ham, and number three is the real Bottas. I know you're a sucker for anything Valtteri Bottas. Anyways, which one will it be?
Number two. No. Number one, the one that got the laughs out of me.
Okay, the ham goat. Okay. Anyway, so Richard has to say, you addressed this tired debate last winter, and I've been stewing over it ever since. I agree that it is useless and academic to debate whether Lewis is the best driver on the grid, or the best driver of his generation, or the greatest of all time. He is objectively all of the latter. He has, under the application of the current rules, soundly beaten his opponents in the turbo hybrid era, save Nico Rosberg. There are certain records that remain to be broken in terms of consecutive poles, race wins, podiums, etc., that Lewis has not yet achieved. But these are footnotes in comparison to the achievement of seven F1 championships. However, I believe the debate needs to shift to the circumstances. The true issue, in my opinion, is the formula and the FIA. They have catered to Mercedes' dominance without sufficient evolution to the level of the playing field. That life is not fair is a boring platitude. However, F1 fans have literally been forced to suffer through 8 years of Mercedes' domination that has become stifling and tiresome. When Mercedes broke out in 2014 and the following seasons, the only race worth watching was the Rosberg/Hamilton duel that played out as both cars finished 20 or 30 seconds ahead of the field. I am no authority, but it seems to me that Bernie Ecclestone would have understood the damage this could have done to the sport and would have found a way to introduce changes to restore some balance given Mercedes' obvious advantage in building the novel power unit. We are 8 years on and the teams are now only catching up, but no car in the grid can match Mercedes' pace. And, in fact, we do not even know what the true pace is, only that the engineers can turn up the engine to whatever level is necessary to catch and beat any pretenders. So, to reiterate, perhaps this debate should be shifted to whether the FIA has done the sport a disservice by allowing a patently unfair technical advantage to continue, unabated for so long. It's a long one, but you know, to get the full points, I think you have to go through the entirety of Richard's thoughts and his comments. So, what do you think? You look like you're thinking very carefully in trying to come up with a response to that.
Yeah, I'm processing, but also I don't know that we're necessarily deserving of that listener's articulate interpretation of the last 7 or 8 years of Formula One history. I think that is an incredibly, incredibly well summarized and laid out.
Well, you should see, I'll let you read the other one. I mean, the points that he makes about Hamilton, the real Hamilton, and then also about the real Bottas, equally as good, just a fantastic email.
Yeah, and I have some thoughts. So one, I don't disagree with really anything that he's spoken to, and I agree that the Mercedes dominance has been problematic for a lot of reasons. And I think for the listeners that are newer to the sport, and we know that there's so many of you out there, and we welcome you and we embrace you because the sport needs you. But the real criticism of Formula One leading into, well, even this year, has been that you've had a single team that has so overwhelmingly dominated the sport at every turn without even the slightest indication that somebody else might be able to compete for a championship short of, I would say, brief brief moments of brilliance from Ferrari in 2018 and 2019 before they were effectively caught cheating, right? So I don't disagree. Like, it's been bad for the sport. I don't agree necessarily that if Bernie Eccleston was still in the sport, that he would have fundamentally implemented changes that would have favored the field at the detriment of Mercedes. It's not the way the sport's necessarily structured. You can't simultaneously unilaterally impose regulation changes at the power unit level or the aerodynamic level. At that level, like, it's something that has to be a collaborative approach, and there needs to be a degree of agreement between the teams and Liberty/Formula One and the FIA. And the reality is, if it was possible to unilaterally or bilaterally impose changes on the sport for the betterment of the other 9 teams, I think we probably would have seen it. In fact, I give tremendous credit to Liberty for immediately recognizing what the state of the sport was when they effectively took it over in early 2017 and began the process of implementing changes. And I think one of the things that they probably don't get enough credit for is they were able to work with the teams on a new Concord agreement in a way that generated relatively little friction. And to be totally honest, in the past, when the teams have been working on developing a new Concord agreement, there's been so much friction that the sport itself has almost been torn apart. So I give Liberty a tremendous amount of credit. I don't think that they could have imposed changes within their first year or two of ownership that could have created the parity that we all want to see. But I think that they've laid the appropriate groundwork, and I don't think it's fast enough for some of our longstanding fans, but I'm kind of curious to hear what your perspective is on this one as well.
You know, it's interesting. I think he raises a lot of good points. And the one that really stood out for me was the one specifically, about Bernie Ecclestone. And, you know, like you raised, it isn't that easy just to implement ways sort of just across the board unilaterally, like I guess was being suggested. But the thing is, Bernie, in some respects, he just always, I don't know if he would do what you would maybe consider was best for the sport. I think he always did what was maybe ultimately best for Bernie. And if that benefited the sport, then I think he would have gone with it. But it kind of got me thinking when I first read this, that would he have had a limit to something like that? And I'm not really too sure, because, I mean, we have seen other periods in Formula One where we've seen other teams dominate. I mean, McLaren back in the 80s and the 90s, and Williams at different times. And then we had that historic run with Michael Schumacher back in the late 90s and early 2000s with the Ferrari. But the thing is that all those sort of dominant eras all sort of naturally kind of, they kind of ran their own course, right? And eventually just, the other teams caught up, or people moved on or retired, or whatever the case may have been. But the thing that's unique about Mercedes is that even though that there's more, I don't want to say parity, but the gap between themselves and the Red Bull of Max Verstappen is closer now than it has been at any time in the past couple of years. I mean, I guess you could go back to 2018 when Ferrari was, at their zenith in this era, when they, Sebastian was mixing it up with Lewis and winning races. And then occasionally, Charles was winning some races there as well in 2019. And then Bottas always winning races in there in that era as well, and still is, of course. But that is just, it's interesting, because when you think about it, there doesn't seem to be any indications that this era of Mercedes dominance is going to come to an end anytime soon. And I don't know what Bernie would have done differently. I mean, it is something I've really been sort of tossing around in my mind the past couple of days. And I know that hindsight is 20/20, and I'm kind of leaning towards the fact that the point that Richard is making, I think it's actually quite valid. I think at some point that and I think maybe that's a little bit different because, viewership and interest seems to be going up. I don't know how much that has to do with, Liberty's increased marketing and the exposure of Formula One in the United States and Drive to Survive and all that. But the one thing that I keep asking myself is if things had stayed the same and viewership and just interest across the board started to decrease and Bernie was still in charge, would then, if he tried to intervene and try and implement some sort of change? I kind of leaning towards that probably he might have. I think he would have. I think if it started hurting the bottom line of Formula One in the pocketbook, I think that's where he would have stepped in.
What do you think he would have done?
Well, that's the thing. I mean, Bernie sometimes had a bit of a flair for the dramatic, and that's where I'm not sure. Like, would it have been something overt and something that he could have implemented from the sort of the management side that he was doing as the rights holder and all that? Or would have it been sort of these sort of backdoor power broker moves, you know, phone calls to, you know, the powerful in the FIA and Formula One and try and force through his agenda, sort of AKA House of Cards, you know, something kind of like, you know, sort of political machinations and things like that. And that's how I think he may have got something done. And, you know, I mean, we can speculate and talk about it because, you know, number one, it's obviously a lot of fun, but, you know, it's number two, we can never prove any of this, but I think he would have maybe tried to have put something in. If it looked like any one of those teams in the past, Williams, Ferrari, McLaren, whoever, if it looked like it was going to drag on nigh on a decade, I think he might have tried to do something one way or another. I get that feeling.
I totally agree. And I hadn't really thought of it that way, but I think if Bernie was effective at anything, it was the backroom deals, and whether they were transparent or above board or even necessarily legal, that's often how he conducted business. And it makes me, I recall now a moment 3 or 4 years ago, and this was prior to Red Bull signing an agreement with Honda for Honda to be their engine supplier. But at the time, Red Bull was receiving power units from Renault, and they'd had a longstanding relationship with Renault, but that relationship had effectively run its course, and there was a huge amount of friction. And Christian Horner and the entire Red Bull organization made it very clear that they wanted Mercedes to be the supplier of their power units. And Mercedes' perspectives, like, we're not legally, contractually, or from a Concord agreement perspective, obligated to provide you engines, and we're not about to start feeding our engines to potentially our chief competitor. And Bernie, and whether it was because he thought that if Red Bull was running Mercedes power units, it could create more parity, and it probably would have, to be totally honest, or whether he just didn't like the leadership team, Toto, etc., at Mercedes. He at the time was putting a tremendous amount of pressure on Mercedes to start supplying power units to the Red Bull team. And the way that he started twisting the knife in a lot of ways was he was very, very, very involved in the production of Formula One television broadcasts. And I don't know if you recall this, but at the peak of the disagreement between Bernie and Formula One and Red Bull and Mercedes, there was a race in Japan, and it was a race where I believe Mercedes finished 1-2. And again, this might be more of an urban legend, but if you go back and watch the race, like, it's factually true. Mm-hmm. The Mercedes cars didn't appear at all on the broadcast. And it was because Bernie had basically said, look, if you're not willing to play ball contractually with working with Red Bull, we're just going to take you off the broadcast. And that's a big problem for Mercedes because all of their sponsors pay to put their logos on the car so they appear on television when you're winning races. So it was just kind of one of those ways that Bernie would kind of twist the knife and work those backroom deals.
Yeah.
But yeah, so he may ultimately have found a way to achieve greater parity, but it probably wouldn't have been through a collaborative approach that brings all the teams along the journey of coming to that same conclusion. It would have been more forceful, backroom oriented.
Yeah, absolutely.
Great question, though.
Yeah, absolutely. Well, I'm going to save one of these ones because they are sort of like evergreen questions. I think I'm going to pick up one of these ones again next week. Okay, next question comes from Alyssa, and this is another good one. It kind of dovetails nicely with the email from Richard. Anyways, Alyssa has to say, quick mailbox question. I'm new to F1 Gen DTS and wondering if fans loved or hated Michael Schumacher when he was dominating. I'm starting to feel a little uncomfortable with the way both fans and often in the F1 media talk about Lewis Hamilton. It just feels really hostile. I understand wanting more competition, but it really feels over the top. Even big media outlets are constantly crediting other things with his success, openly hoping he will lose, and even saying things like maybe he might possibly be the greatest of all time. It's hard to say. I live in LA, and while LeBron gets plenty of hate, I can't fathom anyone from ESPN implying that LeBron might not be the greatest of all time, or one of the greatest of all time. Everyone seems to absolutely love Michael Schumacher, and I'm wondering if he was treated differently when he was racing than when Lewis is. Do F1 fans just not like winning? Is this racial? Even the people from the UK seem desperate for him to lose. Great question. So, you know, I was a fan of Michael Schumacher back in the day. And, you know, when it came to Schumacher, you either loved him or hated him. And there was no middle ground when it came to Schumacher. But she raises a couple of really good points in there. And I saw that you really, you know, threw your hands up there when she made the LeBron comparison. So why don't you pick up on that? I know you're dying to speak on that.
You know what? Fantastic question, and super, super excited that you reached out and asked this question. I think you're right. I think when Michael Schumacher was in the sport, he was dominant, but I don't think he was necessarily disliked for his dominance, but I think he was often disliked because of his racecraft, and he was an ultra, ultra, ultra aggressive driver. And so I don't think people disliked him because he was a German driver. I don't think they disliked him because he was winning championships. Now, the funny thing is, if you go back and talk to anyone back in the 90s and the early 2000s, like, oh, do you watch Formula One? Like, oh, I used to, but I stopped because Michael Schumacher always won. Well, that's BS, and you just didn't watch Formula One. Mm-hmm. Or you talk to people now, like, oh, I was a big Michael Schumacher fan back in the day. Like, oh, what was your favorite race? Like, nah, I can't actually remember any races that he raced in.
Yeah.
But I think you're right. Like, I think he was, I think the disdain for Michael Schumacher was very different. It was, again, not because he was a champion, not because he was German, not because he was white, not for any of those reasons, but simply because if
he was a polarizing figure.
Yeah, he was polarizing. And I think he was polarizing because of what he did on the track, not necessarily what he did off the track. Yeah. I think in the case of Lewis, and I think this is a really astute observation, and I actually believe it's something that we're less aware of in the US and Canada, is that especially in the UK, there are a couple of very specific tabloids who have individuals that cover Formula One that probably have no business covering Formula One, whose entire agenda is to bring down Lewis Hamilton.
Mm-hmm.
And I believe some of it is probably racial. Some of it's, I would suggest, probably quite a bit of it is racial, unfortunately. And I definitely agree. And she makes this wonderful kind of analogy about ESPN and LeBron James. And I'm a huge, 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 huge fan of the NBA and LeBron James. And LeBron James is, interestingly, a very similar analog to Lewis Hamilton, in the sense that he came into the NBA just a couple of years before Lewis Hamilton came into Formula One.
Mm-hmm.
He's very, very, very socially involved. He's very socially conscious, but he's also very, very, very self-aware. And it's interesting because in the US, LeBron James gets an awful lot of flack, despite the fact that as a human being, as a father, as a husband, he's never stepped a foot wrong. Likewise with Lewis, like, you know what, the early part of his career, he was young. He made a couple of, like, I would say, misjudgments off the track, just in terms of personal behavior and things like that. But by and large, he's never really stepped a foot wrong. But I think he faces some of the same criticisms that LeBron gets. But from my perspective, I keep looking at Lewis, and you know what? Maybe you don't love him. Maybe you're not a fan of Mercedes. Maybe you're frustrated because he's run off 7 championships and maybe he didn't deserve that seat, blah, 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 blah. But as long as he's been with Mercedes, he's literally done everything you could have asked for him to do on the track. No mistakes, amazingly consistent. Off the track, no mistakes, amazingly consistent. So maybe it's partly because he is socially progressive, and some of those folks in the media who have the ability to get a message out through a newspaper or a broadcast or whatever, don't necessarily believe in his social justice, more progressive messages. I don't know, but I see it and I hear it, and it's especially acute in the UK for some reason, despite the fact that that's where it's from.
Yeah, you know, it's interesting. And I was thinking about this too. And like, and I've said before that I would like to, it's not that I didn't want to say that I don't want to see Lewis win this year. I want to see somebody else win. But the thing is that
Me
if
too.
The competition is close and he still wins, and you know, I'm still fine with that. I mean, I only don't want to see Lewis win because I think it's time for somebody else to. But I mean, if he's still the best out there, then he deserves it, right? And I mean, I have the absolute greatest amount of respect for Lewis Hamilton and what he's done in Formula One. It's absolutely amazing. And the fact that he's been such a good driver for so long, it really is remarkable. I mean, we can go back to, as Richard said in the previous email, that sort of tired debate about, you know, whether he's the greatest of all time. Is he the greatest of his generation, etc., right? I mean, as I think he pointed out, he is all of the above, right? And it's just... I'm almost pretty much done with this conversation. I mean,
yeah,
like just in general. I mean, he's a fantastic driver. Yes, some people unfortunately don't want to see him win, and for all the different reasons that you properly pointed out. And I wish that the discussion could just move away from that and just enjoy what we're seeing on the track right now, because I'm really loving watching this battle going on between Max and Lewis that we've seen over 4 races. I hope it goes another 19. And, you know, you could throw in that, the wrench that, say, what if they have like a Rosberg-Hamilton incident like they had in Spain or at Spa, you know, that one incident that could take this very tense but very sporting rivalry that these two drivers have and add that sort of, flame to the fire, just really set it off. But, you know, at the end of the day, if Lewis wins title number 8 this year, I'm okay with that. Like I say, I would prefer to see somebody else win, not because I don't want to see Lewis lose, but, you know, it's just time for a change. But, you know, take it for what you want, you know, it's for what it's worth.
I totally agree with everything you said. And I'll just add so we can wrap at this point. Again, fantastic question. Thank you so much for reaching out. Lewis is in a tough position because he races in an era of the world where drivers and athletes and celebrities have a different type of platform than they've ever had before. And when I talk about a platform, I'm talking about accessibility through social media. Michael Schumacher lived in an era where if he didn't want to be disturbed off the track, he could vanish into the countryside, into the mountains, and he was off the face of the planet. And people were cool with that because that's simply how the world was back then. Mm-hmm. With Lewis, he's in this really tough position because he has the best car, arguably, in the history of the sport. So the expectation is that he wins, and he does win every single year. So he's criticized for winning because he's got the best car. But if he didn't win, he'd also be criticized. And then from an accessibility and a social media perspective, he has this platform and there's a tremendous amount of pressure on him to leverage his platform for social justice and socially aware messaging, etc. And he does that. But if he didn't do that, he would also be criticized for not leveraging his celebrity and his status. So he's just in this really difficult position that I think a lot of modern athletes are, which is you've got this group of alleged sports fans that are like, hey, shut up and drive. Like, I think you probably remember this with LeBron years ago, which was shut up and dribble from this far right conservative commentator, right? Like, they're in this challenging position where, you know what, if they did just focus on their craft and they stayed quiet on socially conscious and socially aware issues, they'd be criticized. And if they don't comment, they're criticized. He's just in this tough position, to be totally honest.
Yeah, you're damned if you do and you're damned if you don't.
Exactly.
Anyways, guys, we're not worthy of these wonderful emails. I mean, we turned this into like half a show just from three emails. I mean, that's just how spoiled we are. Anyways, we're going to take a quick break. When we come back, Toto Wolff is going to weigh in on what he thinks is the state of the, I guess you could call it Red Bull rating Mercedes for brain power for their new engine program. We'll do that in just a moment, so don't go away. We'll be right back.
Have you ever experienced turbulence on a flight and wondered why?
And you can see all the terrain around you. You've got no issue with visibility or anything?
No, everything's peachy.
Maybe you've sat on the tarmac for hours wondering why your plane isn't moving.
Well, we're outside here. They're saying the ramp is closed. They won't let us park because of Air Force One.
Listen in on the conversations between pilots and air traffic controllers on the Air Traffic Out of Control podcast.
510 is declaring an emergency. There's smoke in the cabin. I need to make a landing right now on 31 left.
We have the most interesting, wild, and funny ATC recordings you will ever hear. Check out Air Traffic Out of Control wherever you listen to your favorite podcasts.
All right, well, welcome back to the show. So, Toto Wolff says that 15 staff and an empty factory are not enough for Red Bull to start building basically competitive power units by 2025. So anyways, Toto had to say, quote, "We have about 900 people working in Brixworth. They approach 100 and they got between 10 and 15, mainly manufacturing staff, no performance. And in that respect, if I were to build a new factory, I would also start like that. Between hiring two handful of people and having a full up and running competitive engine factory, there's quite a long way to go. I think Red Bull can do it with the resource that is being put in, but Mercedes and the others have been in the sport for many decades building the structure. So 50 guys in an empty building site construction is not going to be sufficient in order to be competitive in 3 years with a new power unit. Having said that, we're taking them very seriously because they are a great team and have the finances to do so. But if we know one thing in Formula One, that it needs time, no money can accelerate the learning curve," end quote. So yeah, certainly that that last portion of the quote, ask Honda, they know that 110%. I mean, when they came back into the sport in, what was it, 2015? Yeah, they were a country mile behind everybody else in terms of performance. But it's interesting the way that he's sort of downplaying the I don't want to say the quality of the people that Red Bull has lured away from Mercedes, but more the type of the people that they've lured over to their new engine program. More sort of hands-on people rather than sort of the brainiacs, the nerds that are going to design and be the, I guess, the real brain power behind this engine program.
I almost feel a little bit ashamed because when we were discussing the story last week about the fact that, wow, 2 weeks ago they'd recruited one person away, and oh my gosh, now they've recruited a dozen people and we're waving our hands in the air, like what's going on with the culture in Brixworth? But I think he does a really good job of putting this into perspective, right? It's like, hey, we lost 15 people. We have 900 people working in Brixworth, and Brixworth is the small town in the UK where Mercedes develops their power units. It's about 20 or 30 minutes away from their core factory. But yeah, he puts this into perspective, right? Which is Mercedes has 900 people at the facility where they develop their power unit. They've lost 10 or 15. That's nothing. That's a fraction of a percentage of the total workforce. And ultimately, he also puts it into perspective, which is currently, and I'm not necessarily sure how he knows this, but Red Bull have 100 full-time staff working on the power unit that they're trying to get ready for 2025. And what's crazy about that is we don't really even know what that power unit's going to look like yet or what the characteristics of that power unit are going to be. So they can't be doing anything meaningful yet. Mm-hmm. And the reality is the power unit that they're running this year, next year, and the year after is pretty much set in stone. And I think a lot of the heavy lifting that they're doing right now is that engine's been developed in Japan. The facility that's been developing that power unit is based in Japan. So really, they're just bringing all of the brain trust and the IP over and setting up shop so that they can start building slightly modified future variations and iterations of that power unit. But he's absolutely right. In fact, the message he has here is not only we're not worried about losing the 15 guys, but Red Bull's in a position where they need to be worried about having enough people to be able to develop an engine in time for 2025. It was an interesting twist on the story last week because I think we came in panic. Mercedes is in big trouble, and Toto's like, nah. Cool your jets, boys. There's no issue here.
Yeah, you know, I think obviously he's always going to downplay it, but you know, when he puts in that light, it really kind of makes it sound like it is absolutely no big deal that the people they got are not going to really significantly impact the operations of either team, to be quite frank, but certainly very interesting. And when you kind of put it in that respect that, you know, they've got 100 people for the Red Bull engine program right now, and they're certainly going to have a lot of work to do in the next couple of years. I mean, they are going to get a little bit of support from Honda in the meantime, but they've got their homework, piles of it in front of them, or else the engine that they have in 2025 might be more akin to what Fred Flintstone had in his car other than what they might be expecting. Of course, I'm being a little bit flippant there. Hey, moving on to the next one, this was kind of stood out, and this was a comment by Liberty Media's CEO Greg Maffei, who was talking about the cost cap, and this is quite funny. I'll just read the entire quote. It says, quote, Bernie Ecclestone and Max Mosley, after the 2009 recession, tried to get a cost cap in and couldn't get it done. We got there. Dumb Americans, what do we know about the sport? We say we want to get it done and they laugh at us. Chase gets it done, full credit Chase and team. So Chase did an amazing job changing the tone, setting the sport in the right direction, and above all, getting that Concord agreement with the cost cap. Chase remains our non-exec chair and that relationship is valuable, end quote. You know, I thought it was kind of interesting because, of course, the article I saw was a little bit clickbaity. I mean, the whole dumb Americans were laughed at kind of thing, but it is interesting just the way that he kind of frames it there. He says, dumb Americans, what do we know about the sport? Well, obviously they probably didn't know as much about the sport compared to the people that were there before them. But I think what they understood was the property that they had and the fact that the financial model that was in place was just not sustainable. And that's why I find this whole thing that goes back to last year, the whole cost cap, the whole, the whole new Concord agreement, all these emergency cost measures that were put in place in the middle of a freaking pandemic, which at the beginning, I mean, you talked to the beginning of the show, you know, now there's light at the end of the tunnel because we're, 15 months into this thing. We have vaccinations going on around the world. I mean, back, in the spring of 2020, I mean, things were very, very different. And they managed to get all these things done. And I think that they really do deserve credit because I have made this comment before that I think that Bernie did a really good job building Formula One to what he did over that 40 years or whatever it was that he was in charge. But he took it as far as he went. And I still wonder, I sometimes think about this whenever I hear these cost cap comments come up, that if the Liberty hadn't come back or taken over in 2017 or whatever it was, and Bernie was still in charge, or his organization was still in charge, where would we have been with Formula One when COVID hit and everything started falling apart? Because I really, when I think about it, I don't want to say that with Liberty we dodged a bullet, but I think that might be a little bit too extreme. But I think that what they did, that they absolutely deserve the credit for, because I think that they took what was obviously a very precarious situation, which, you know, all the teams and the sport in general were just hemorrhaging money because they weren't racing, they weren't getting ticket revenue, they weren't getting TV revenue, and all those sorts of things, that they took them in a very dangerous position and stabilized it and put a floor in that, yeah, guys, we've really hit rock bottom here, but we can build from here and hopefully not sink any lower.
I think there's been some, I don't know if you would call it criticism, but I think some of the analysts in the media suggested that the only reason the Concord Agreement came together so easily in 2020 was because of the global economic circumstances and the uncertainty related to the global economy. I don't necessarily buy that. I think Liberty as a group instilled a tremendous amount of trust in the core members of Formula One, the Formula One family, at least when it comes to the teams that compete in the championship. I think that they have a tremendous amount of respect for Liberty. I think they absolutely buy into the vision. I mean, ultimately, if you look at what was achieved with that Concord agreement, it was a cost cap. And the last time that Formula One and the FIA tried to impose a cost cap on the sport, it was coming out of the 2008 recession. And for those of you that weren't around back then, the series almost split apart. And I just bring this up in the background, but June 18th, 2009, amongst incredibly contentious negotiations for the new Concord agreement, the Formula One Teams Association has announced that it is setting up a breakaway championship. June 2009, Ferrari, McLaren, Renault, BMW, Sauber, Toyota, Braun, Red Bull Racing, and Toro Rosso have announced that they are leaving Formula One to create their own championship. Like, that's where we've come to where we are now, which is that the teams are collaborative and they're absolutely involved. And I think they trust the vision that ultimately Liberty has for the future of the sport. And again, last year was unique, right? And you make this great point about the fact that early on, the sport was hemorrhaging money. And they're hemorrhaging money because they have a huge dependency on the revenue that comes from TV deals. But if you're not racing, you don't get that cash. So last year, one of the reasons why Liberty was in the teams as well, right? Like, it ultimately, like, the calendar may have been condensed. It may have been really challenging from the teams from a logistical perspective, but it was in the interest of everyone involved to stage as many races as you could, even if there was nobody there, because the more races you were able to put on the calendar, the more TV revenue you were able to cash in. Mm-hmm. And I think we've seen recently as well, a lot of criticism from folks within the sport, like, hey, racing 23 races a year, 25 races a year, puts a lot of strain on the teams. You know, it wasn't Liberty that unilaterally agreed or decided to do 25 races. Like, the 25 races was agreed upon by all of the teams because they saw the net benefit of the TV revenue and the ticket revenue that would be associated with those additional events. I can't even remember now what the original question was, and I've gone on this crazy tangent, so I'll throw it back to you.
No, it was just basically the comments from Greg Maffei just about the whole dumb Americans not knowing anything about Formula One. But I just go back to the original point. I think they knew what they had in terms of a property and how valuable it was and how scalable the sport is in terms of building it in certain areas of the world that remain untapped or underdeveloped market.
Yeah,
the U.S.
States.
For once. Yeah, absolutely. And, I don't think that Formula One is completely out of the woods just yet. I mean, the one thing that I think is amazing is in all the turmoil that we saw at the beginning of the pandemic, we didn't lose any teams. I know that it was very touch and go with Haas. Williams, I still worry a little bit about, but maybe less so than Haas because they have the new owners with Derrilton Capital. So from a financial standpoint, I think Williams is a little bit better. Haas, I still have some significant question marks about how solid this team is and, how committed Gene Haas is to Formula One and all that. But I go back to what I said right off the top here. I think they do deserve the credit. So let's
go ahead. I'm just going to add to this as well, because The finance and the economy of Formula One is my favorite subject in the world, and I don't want to spend too much time on this, but I totally agree with those comments that I think there was a lot of skepticism about Liberty and how they were going to be able to bring the teams together. And again, when I talk about skepticism, it goes right back to that same traditional old guard British press. Hmm. And the old guard British press has a disproportionate voice in the world of Formula One because so much of the sport is based in that country.
Yeah.
The other thing I think now too that probably hasn't been the case in the past, especially coming out of the recession in 08, 09, is that we're in this global economic kind of asset bubble. And I think probably now more than ever, sports teams are highly valued as an asset. And I would suspect that if any of the Formula One teams became available today, I think there would be a huge amount of demand to buy into the sport. If the sport is going to continue on this upward trajectory in terms of viewership and revenue and global exposure, I think the fact that there's only 10 teams mm-hmm. makes them incredibly valuable. And to be totally honest, I honestly believe that the best possible thing for the sport is if Haas exited the sport and allowed somebody more astute at ownership and management was able to step in. And again, Haas has demonstrated that he can run a world-class racing organization in terms of NASCAR, but he hasn't been able to demonstrate the ability to do that in Formula One. And maybe that's because of the leadership team that he's put in place there. But I have no concerns that the sport would be able to find a really quality owner very quickly. And it's funny too, like I've heard stories from Ross Brawn about when the Honda team was put up for sale at the end of, I guess it was the end of 08. Mm-hmm. And they talked about the fact that they were taking meetings with people that were straight up scammers and pirates and had no equity or no capital at all. But they were so desperate to find a new owner, they had to sit through these meetings. I don't think that would be the case now. And I think there would be a lineup of people that would want to buy into the sport.
Yeah, I think that you raised some good points. I think that one person that might be interested in buying Haas would, I think, be Mazepin Sr. I think this whole sponsorship thing that he has with the Uruguay, I think it's just sort of a foothold, kind of a doorway into Formula One, and I wouldn't be surprised.
Totally agree. That if it's terrifying, but I totally agree.
Yeah, I think that if Gene Haas was to say that that he was pulling out, I think that immediately that the Mazepins would be the first logical people to be linked with taking that team over.
And just remember as well that it's alleged or understood that they bid on Force India and bid at a value higher than ultimately Lawrence Stroll's family did, but they weren't interested in saving jobs and bringing that company out of administration. They just wanted the asset that was the Formula One team, and ultimately they went in a different direction, but they're very hungry for an F1 team. You're absolutely right.
Well, I mean, they even took that one even went to the courts ultimately. The whole case that they tried to push forward didn't succeed, but they're certainly very keen on owning a Formula One team. Hey, let's take another break here, Mark. When we come back, I want to talk about teams that are done and not done with developing their cars over the course of the remainder of the season. We'll do so in just a moment, so don't go away. We'll be right back. All right, well, welcome back to the show. So, team number one that is not done yet, or not done quite yet, with upgrading their 2021 car is McLaren. So, they said that Andreas Seidel, team principal, says that they're still going to continue with the updates in an effort to stay ahead of Ferrari or beat them in the Constructors' championship this year. And obviously, this is going to be a real trade-off because we've got this whole new era of Formula One coming next year with the brand new cars. So there's obviously a big risk in how much time and how much personnel and resources that they commit to this current car in and pull away from next year's car. But I think that's interesting because when you sort of you put that up against the other team that's basically come out and said that they're not going to focus anymore on this year. It's the McLaren's number one rival, and that's Ferrari. So McLaren says that they're going to throw more resources in to beat Ferrari, and Ferrari's like, meh, we're about 90-95% focused on next year's car. It's not like they're going to completely throw the towel in on the year, but Laurent Mekies, who's the sporting director for Ferrari Formula One, says that they're really focused on the development of next year's car, and they're not going to compromise that approach in any aspect just to try and stay ahead of McLaren this year. So I guess McLaren is seeing seeing that opportunity to get ahead of Ferrari and the constructors and the associated financial reward. But I think it's really interesting that it's these two contrasting stances that both of these teams who are direct rivals with one another are taking. Ferrari obviously taking more of a long-term and midterm view, and McLaren focusing a little bit heavier on the short term, but also with an eye on the future as well.
I think with McLaren, there's also an economic necessity to being successful this season and finishing ahead of Ferrari. And ultimately, the amount of money that is paid to you from the championship is driven at least in part by how you finish in the Constructors' Championship. And if you finish third, you're going to get a greater payout than if you finish fourth. And the challenge for McLaren, and we've discussed this at length over the last 5 or 6 months, is there's not been economic uncertainty, but there's certainly been economic stresses and pressures placed on that team from a road car division perspective. They've had to lay off people. They've had to sell the McLaren Technology Center with a leaseback agreement. They've had to do some things to free up capital. So I think for them, securing capital this year from the championship is important. But likewise, the better they finish in the championship, the easier it is for their sales team to go and drum up sponsorship agreements for this team. And I think from a McLaren perspective, or from a Ferrari perspective, you know what? The difference of $5 to $10 to $15 million this year is almost negligible for that team. Their sponsorships are secured. They're a highly profitable, lucrative organization. I think for them, they can afford to have more of a long-term outlook. And ultimately, this year, if we finish fourth, great. If we finish third, great. But ultimately, we want to put our resources towards building a car that could compete for a championship next year. Whereas McLaren, like, hey, we need the cash infusion that's going to come with finishing third in the championship this year, which is also going to enable us to chase some bigger sponsorships. So I think the priorities are very different for those two teams.
Yeah, and with Ferrari, it's completely in line with what they've been saying probably for, what, the last 18 months, that they don't really expect to be in the position to compete for a championship until 2022, 2023, somewhere in that window. So they're sticking with that vision, and they're not deviating from that in public anyways. But it's interesting too, because as you were talking there, I just brought up a picture of the MCL34, this year's McLaren. And when you look at, there's a number of really big name sponsors on there. There's Gulf, there's Coca-Cola, there's Dell, there's MSNBC, just to name a couple right off the top. But the one thing that really strikes me when I look at that car is that there's still a lot of empty space that you could slap a nice couple big logos on there. So if you're McLaren and you're thinking that you want to sell some real estate to potential sponsors, you've got a lot of space on your car that you could do it. So being in that in that sort of mindset and getting a better position in the championship and maybe getting more time, screen time, because you got a bit more competitive time, that absolutely makes it a lot easier to pitch from their sales and marketing people to potential sponsors.
And we alluded to this on Twitter over the last couple of days. It looks like McLaren has some sort of announcement coming this Sunday, and that they briefed some members of the media who also teased that there's something coming on Sunday, but they couldn't speak to it. It's understood it's some sort of sponsorship agreement or arrangement. Mm-hmm. So we'll have to see how that plays out. And of course, we'll retweet whatever happens on Sunday. But yeah,
it's you're not going to tell them now.
I don't know. If I knew, I would share it on the air.
Come on, don't be so humble. I mean, we were going to wait till Sunday to announce the big. Okay, I'm just kidding. It's not us.
Our logo is going to appear on the wing of the McLaren for the rest of the season.
Yeah, if only, right? But yeah, no, that'd be really cool. So, I mean, that's one thing that I've been looking out for. I mean, the one thing that that some of these marketing types in Formula One do is tease very well. I mean, the Aston Martin people did a phenomenal job over the winter. Unfortunately, the car just did not live up to the hype thus far. But certainly, I mean, they did a great job. McLaren also teasing as well. So, anyways, let's move on to the next one. Sticking with Ferrari, and Matteo Binotto believes that the team's performance at the Spanish Grand Prix last weekend proves that they have overcome what he called race day weaknesses seen earlier this season. So is he basically saying that they're back? I feel like I want to say that Binotto is saying that Ferrari's back, but he's kind of not really overtly saying it. He's just saying, well, okay, we're no longer having the same weaknesses as before. So it's kind of not an admission, right?
Yeah, we'll see. It's early, and I think we have reason to be excited about how Ferrari's performed so far. I mean, they've scored points finish, I think, and let me just check here. Yeah, week one, a sixth and an eighth, and then a fourth and a fifth, and a sixth and 11th, and then a fourth and a seventh. I think their performance so far is probably exceeding the expectations of most analysts. I think you and I talked when we did our preview show that they could be a bit of a sleeper, a dark horse, and I think they're probably slotting in exactly where we expected them to be. I think the challenge with Ferrari last year was there was a whole bunch of different issues, right? They had drag issues, they had performance issues, and then ultimately they had driver issues, they had team chemistry issues, and they've solved a lot of those issues. The power unit seems to be in a better state, the drag issues seem to be reduced, there's no chemistry issues. And then the other challenge that they had last year as well is they had some reliability issues, they had strategy issues, they had pit issues, everything kind of fell apart, and it just seems to be a more cohesive organization this year, and that's helped help drive 60 points in the championship after four races.
Yeah, I think that they should be pretty pleased with where they are right now. I mean, obviously, it's not at the front of the pack leading the way and leading the championships, but I think that after the disastrous two-thirds of 2020, I mean, they really didn't turn it around and look even remotely competitive until the last several races of the year, and it was just discouraging because at one point they were almost on pace with comparably with the Williams compared to where they should be, right? And they've turned it around slowly but surely, and like you say, I mean, one of the big things is that the chemistry between the two drivers is completely it's much improved. And I think that Sainz, I don't want to say that maybe he's the most underrated driver of the year so far, but I think maybe he gets in that conversation. I think that maybe sort of a sleeper, maybe somebody we expected to take a little bit longer to feel more comfortable at a new team and a new car. Because, I mean, we've seen everybody else that's with a new team this year struggle to a certain extent. But for Sainz, that learning curve doesn't seem to have been as steep for, say, Perez or some of the rookies or for Sebastian Vettel. I mean, Vettel obviously is dealing with car issues as well. But Sainz, to me, seems to have struggled less in adapting to a new team than, say, even like Perez or Ricciardo, for example.
That's a really great observation and probably something that we haven't given him enough credit for, right? Which is he made the transition like a lot of drivers did in the offseason from one team to another. So he had to learn a new factory, a new culture, a new chassis, and a new power unit. Maybe I think one of the things that's benefited him is that this isn't the first time he's made a move from one car to another car, from one power unit to another power unit. So he's done that before. But you're right. And again, his performances have been okay. An eighth, a fifth. He finished out of the points in Portugal, and then he rebounded to seventh in Spain. So it's been a solid performance. He's got 20 points in the championship. He looks pretty good. He's certainly improving. And I think his performance and his start probably could have been better if he had more than 3 days of winter testing. Mm-hmm. But to be fair, the same could have been said for the whole field. But yeah, quietly putting together a reasonably strong finish. Now, that said, he only has half this championship points that his teammate Charles Leclerc has, who has finished sixth, fourth, sixth, and fourth since. Finished just off the I shouldn't say just off the podium. On paper, he finished just off the podium, but in reality, it was more than 10 or 20 seconds back. But ultimately, I think this is probably where Ferrari would have expected to see him after four races.
Yeah, I mean, if you look at the Drivers' Championship, he's currently eighth, 20 points, 4 points behind Danny Ricciardo, which you would think would be the next driver that he'd really be competing with. And then he's 12 points behind Sergio Perez, who has 32, which is obviously, not a sufficient amount of points for a guy that's driving that car. But I mean, when you look at it in the standings like that, he's behind both of those drivers, but still, I think that he's been a little bit more, I guess, a little bit more consistent, a little bit more reliable. And like I said, to me, it seems like he struggled less than those other two. Now, whether or not he can really build upon those building blocks over the first four races and do something with that and maybe pass Ricciardo or challenge Perez. I mean, I keep thinking at some point Perez has got to turn it around and figure this car out and really do a more solid job and do what's expected of him. But certainly Sainz, I think, is... I think he's one that we need to keep an eye on moving forward. Okay, well, let's move on to the next one. And this is, I can see you wanting to start pulling your hair out now. And this is Sebastian Vettel at Aston Martin. I mean, both of you and I were really looking forward to seeing what Aston Martin could do. You'll build upon that racing point from last year and build, an Aston Martin branded car. It's been very disappointing. And Seb is just admitting, he's flat out saying that he doesn't have the pace currently to really fight for points. And this was, you know, comes on the heels of what he said was another frustrating weekend last weekend in Spain. And, well, it's hard to disagree with that. I mean, I mean, Lance has had some points finishes here or there, but they haven't really been, you know, we would have expected him to finish higher up. I mean, based on what we saw last year, it's just a frustrating situation to watch. And Lance, I think, has got a bit of a benefit because he's getting the updates a little bit earlier than Sebastian. But regardless if it's Vettel or Stroll, it's just a bit painful to watch this team at the moment.
I guess ultimately their biggest challenge is, and you're absolutely right, during the offseason, I was buying a ton of Aston Martin stock. Not literally, but emotionally, psychologically, I was all in an Aston Martin.
Yep.
But I think the challenge is that they went into 2020 and they brought out this Challenger that obviously in a lot of ways fundamentally cloned the Mercedes car of 2019. And the challenge is, while that was great last year and it helped them win a Grand Prix, we move into 2021 and the regulation changes changed again. And unfortunately, the car that they brought last year was brought back to the grid this year, but it's fundamentally incompatible with what would denote or what would generate a great racing car this year. So they're in this bad place where ultimately the car that they have last year isn't compatible with the regulations this year. It's creating all kinds of issues with aerodynamics and drag and all these other kind of pieces. And then ultimately the cars just aren't competitive. And you and I have talked about this before. I don't see a way out of this for them this year,
no,
given the limits that they have on resources and whether they even want to invest a lot of energy in this car, whether they want to focus on 2022. And it's funny too, because they're not bad enough that you could talk about them in the context of the NBA being a lottery team. Like in the NBA, you're either a top four, a top eight seed, and you're competing for a championship, or you're a lottery team. And if you're either of those, you get a lot of exposure. But if you're that team that's kind of 16 to 24, you're kind of in this no man's land, and Aston Martin's kind of there right now, where they're not so bad that they're laughably broken at the bottom of the championship, but they're not even in a position where they can reliably compete for points. And I think it's unfortunate because, one, the cars look incredible on the track, but yep, there's no reason to show them on the broadcast, so ultimately they don't. I'm frustrated with the situation, and I think what I'm struggling to understand from Vettel's comments here is he saying he doesn't have pace because of the car, or because he's not necessarily bringing that pace? But ultimately, while Lance is outperforming him, he's not that much ahead of him, at least in the last couple of Grand Prix. And, you know, Vettel outqualified him a couple of races ago. So I think fundamentally it's the car. I think he's becoming more familiar with the package, but maybe that doesn't matter if the car's just not that great.
Yeah, and you raise a really good point, too, when you say, like, how much are they really investing and how much are they committed to developing this car? Are they really focusing now on 2022 when it really is going to be an Aston Martin in its own right rather than a rebranded and rebadged Racing Point?
Totally, and I think now more than ever, last year was not a fluke, but a bit of an anomaly. They caught lightning in a bottle. They cloned the car from 2019. That was very successful. It led to some great success last year, and they would have finished third in the championship if not for the 15 points that were, I shouldn't say stolen, but taken from them because of the brake duct situation. And then because of the way that the championship played out this year, the fact that they basically had to roll back last year's cars, there were regulation changes, and suddenly the car that was successful for them last year can't be successful based on the regulations that are imposed in 2021. So,
you know,
bad timing.
My expectations for them this year, and call it naive, call it wishful thinking, call it whatever you will, but at minimum, I expected them to be in the same position where they left off last year, and that would have been fighting with the Ferraris, fighting with the McLarens, and actually, I was hoping that perhaps that gap to the Red Bulls and the Mercedes was lessened a little bit, but this whole, you know, this whole setback that they've been dealt with the aero rules for this year has really impacted them in a big way. And yeah, it's disappointing. I was really hoping to, I mean, I'm going to cheer for Lance regardless because, you know, he's Canadian guy. So we're always going to cheer for the home team, right? Cheer for the hometown guy. But it is a frustrating one to see. Anyways, Mark, let's take a little bit of a quick break here. And then when we come back, Gunther Steiner has had some stuff to say about Toto Wolff. And we'll talk about that in just a moment. So don't go away. We'll be right back. All right. Well, welcome back to the show. And yes, you know, this is funny. Well, maybe it's not funny. Maybe it just proves I'm a little bit weird. But anyways, when I saw this article about Gunther Steiner, team principal of Haas, talking about Toto Wolff and how Toto wanted what he called a little bit of publicity when he got on race radio over the weekend to complain about the blue flags and Nikita Mazepin holding up his cars and everything like that. You know, I can't help it, and maybe it's DTS, but every time I read a Steiner quote, I hear his voice in my head.
Me too,
you know, I don't know what it is, and I don't necessarily get that when you have other team principals like Toto Wolff has a very strong accent, maybe not quite as strong as Gunther's, but still, I don't know. He's always been one of the sort of standout personalities in Drive to Survive. I mean, he's obviously quite pointed in some of his comments. Anyways, what Gunther had to say was, quote, "I didn't hear the message. They just told me in the debrief that Toto said something, but I don't know exactly why and what he said that. So I cannot comment because I do not know the circumstances, but I think Nikita did a good job today to get out of it. Maybe Toto being Toto just wanted everything or wanted to make sure that he's here showing who is in command here and that everybody should move when he's coming along, you know. He put himself on the radio and didn't let his guys do the work. He wanted a little bit of publicity, I guess. So
yeah,
end quote.
Toto needs publicity.
I don't know. I'd love to hear the actual quote, because the way that that I read this almost sounds like a little bit tongue in cheek. You know, like if you read the headline, it seems a little bit cheeky. It seems like a little bit. You know, a little bit, almost putting Toto down a little bit when you actually read it, it comes up as a very, it doesn't seem very serious. It seems like a very lighthearted kind of brushing it off kind of thing. Like, oh yeah, well, whatever. It's just maybe wanted some publicity kind of thing, right?
Yeah, I totally agree.
Yeah, yeah.
It's funny too, because we're conditioned and obviously for many, many, many years, not necessarily live, but we've always heard snippets of the driver pit communication. So you'll hear Hamilton five times a race talking about how his tires are done, his tires are done, his tires are done. You'll hear a lot of the drivers complaining about Mazepin getting in their way, blah, 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 blah. But by all accounts, this was the first time on the F1 global feed that a message from a message to race control from one of the teams has been aired. So I think what Gunther Steiner is saying here is that this entire situation was manufactured, that obviously Toto knew that during the broadcast, they were going to broadcast a conversation between race control and one of the teams, and that Toto injected or inserted himself into the microphone to make sure that it was his comments that were heard. So it's kind of speculative, it's kind of conspiratorial, but it's also just kind of funny that Gunther Steiner, of all people, is criticizing Toto Wolff for seeking attention when Toto Wolff gets all the attention and glory and glamour he possibly needs. And Gunther Steiner himself is a bit of a, I don't want to call him a bit of a clown, but he's obviously opinionated and very authentic and very real. And I also have that same issue that you do, which is every time I read a Gunther Steiner quote, I hear the voice, but I also hear the quote prefaced by 17 F words and concluded with 14 more F words, because if you've watched Drive to Survive, he doesn't hold back on the cursing, which I actually kind of appreciate as well, because I just appreciate that he could be authentic. But yeah, I thought this whole thing was kind of funny.
Yeah, I did too. I thought it was kind of funny just the way that they did it. But, you know, it's funny too, because we never really hear like Toto on the race radio, like period. And I kind of wondered that too when I heard that and I read this article too. It's just like, how manufactured was this? Like, what was this, the producers picking up on the fact that people have been focusing and complaining about Mazepin, and there's this sort of this thread about him being, you know, like the not most experienced driver. He's a slow driver. You know, we've talked about it quite a bit. And I thought, too, that perhaps that there might have been a bit of a, oh, this is the perfect soundbite to grab. You know, Toto is on the radio right at the perfect time. Let's air this one, you know.
Totally.
And unfortunately, I wish we could get more of those, Gunther Steiner F-bombs on race radio. But I guess that's not really family friendly in the course of a normal race broadcast. Anyways, let's talk now about Sergio Perez, who said that the compressed time that he had in the testing schedule over the winter is really, it's really holding him back in the season so far. And he said he feels, and I feel that this is a bit of an understatement. He said it feels like it's taking him too long to get up to speed in the Red Bull this year. And I totally agree. I mean, I don't think that there is any doubt that this switch to Red Bull, the fact that he had limited time, just like everybody else, has really hurt him more. And like I said in the beginning of the show when we were talking about it, that it kind of makes me wonder that if they stick with this compressed testing schedule, whether that will maybe influence, I guess is the word that I'm looking for, drivers and moves that they're making rather than just jumping from one team to another. I mean, drivers will change all the time, but maybe I'm wondering if drivers will start to think, maybe take a second guess on whether they're doing the right thing, knowing that I'm in a good spot right now, but if I switch, I'm only going to have 3 days to test a car over the winter or whatever it might be. And do I really want to set myself further back in order to move forward at another team?
I think that's a really great question. I think it maybe doesn't apply to Sergio, and you know this, obviously, in this circumstance, because he was in a situation where he didn't have a choice, where ultimately his future was predetermined because the Force India /Racing Point/Aston Martin team had already made an agreement to bring in Sebastian Vettel, despite the fact that he was in the middle of a 3-year contract. But I think you're right. If I'm a driver and I'm in a really good situation and there's an alternative lucrative offer, maybe I weigh the pros and cons and just stay where I am, because you're right. The cost to my career of struggling through the first 4 or 5 races, trying to adjust to a new team, a new car, a new chassis, a new power unit, could be pretty devastating. We alluded to this earlier in the race, but historically, winter testing in Formula One has been as much as 2 weeks, 2 4-day weeks. So you would potentially get 8 sessions to become familiar with a car. And there used to be in-season testing and all of these different opportunities. But again, the teams agreed with the new cost cap, with the new Concorde agreement, that 3 days of winter testing were going to be the norm. They all agreed to this. Now, the drivers may not have been a part of that decision, but the teams agreed and they needed to have understood what the knock-on effects were going to be. Now, in terms of Sergio, again, we talked about this last week, man. Like, he's not a young driver. He's 11 years deep in this journey. He's been with 3 different teams, 4 different teams, a multitude of different chassis and power units. He was around in the V8s. He's been around for the hybrid era. He doesn't have as much of an excuse, I believe, as Gasly and Albon in terms of adapting to this car. And I know we talked last week and we alluded to the fact that, hey, maybe there's just something really unique, or there's some characteristic that makes the Red Bull car very special and challenging to drive, if your name isn't Max Verstappen. But like one of our listeners, Randy, called out, the reality is, prior to Albon and prior to Gasly, they had another driver in that car, and Daniel Ricciardo, who had no control, no issues piloting that car to race wins. So ultimately, I think it's on Sergio at this point, and he needs to figure this out.
Yeah, especially for, like you say, for a guy that's over a decade deep into his Formula One career, that you would expect, yeah, sure, initially you might be having some challenges, but, almost a quarter of the way into the season, you would think that those challenges and those issues that he's dealing with would be pretty much solved by now.
And hey, Mark, just one more thing on there too. He's got a 1-year deal. So nobody needs to put any more pressure on him than he's putting on himself. 1-year deal and it's done, potentially.
Yeah, potentially. And that's a great point, because that makes you wonder if some of the issues that he is having is maybe self-inflicted, just because the amount of pressure he's heaping on himself to get it right and deliver what Red Bull and he expect that he can do with that car. So that is a great point. I mean, we're going to have to watch this because certainly the longer that this drags on for, obviously doesn't play out well for him in terms of trying to go back and get another contract out of these guys. But then again, we have the circular conversation when it comes to Red Bull. We've been having it almost every year now since Ricciardo left at the end of 2018, that if they don't bring back Perez next year, who are they going to bring up to that team instead? Are they going to try and bring Gasly back? Do they have somebody else? I mean, Perez is the first guy that they basically brought in from outside that organization. So it's kind of fun to talk about, because it's a story that kind of keeps on giving, but it certainly is. There's no shortage of fuel for this fire. Let's put it that way.
Totally.
Okay, let's move on to the next one. I'm trying to speed this up because I know you're trying to get to MotoGP Corner. So
no, I've been waiting to get to Bendy Wings. That's okay. The highlight of the show for me today. Bendy Wings.
I was going to talk about the Bendy Wings because you brought it up because the article you sent me, the lead in it was clampdown on flexible rear wings amid suspicions that some teams are bending the rules. Ooh. And I love that because I was just like, you know, is this a pun? Was this intended? Was this accidental? Because it's a brilliant way to describe it. And well, let's talk about it in a moment. Let's just take one quick final break because then we can talk about Bendy Wings. Then we can talk about MotoGP and everybody can go home happy. And if everybody's already at home, they can just stay happy. Anyways, so let's take that quick break and we'll come back in just a moment. So don't go away. We'll be right back. All right, welcome back to the show. And Bendy Wings, I'm not going to steal any of it. Mark, go for it.
This is a great topic. And for those of you that aren't super interested in the technical side of Formula One, bear with me because I'm going to try to make this a little bit fun. So if you're new to Formula One, you're part of that Gen DTS. There's all kinds of fun stuff that happens on the track. The racing, the bumping, all that kind of stuff. There's a lot to talk about with drivers and their performance and driver personalities and all those kind of pieces. But one of the topics that always dominates the discussion in Formula One is the technical regulations of the sport. Ultimately, Formula One cars they're not prototype cars in the sense that teams can do whatever they want from a design perspective, but it's closer to the prototype concept than potentially any other mainstream racing series in the world. That said, the cars are still highly, 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 highly regulated. And today in Nerd Talk, we're going to talk about the rear wing on the back of the cars. The rear wing on the back of the car serves a couple of purposes. One, it creates drag, and two, it creates downforce. Drag is designed to slow the car down, and downforce is designed to help keep the car stuck on the ground. If you were to take a Formula One car and you were to remove that rear wing and let it go wide open on a 1 or 2 kilometer straight, there's the very real risk that that car would take off from the ground. So the rear wing serves a fundamental safety purpose, but it also helps provide a tremendous amount of grip, especially in the corner. Now, from an F1 team's perspective, the challenge with a rear wing is that in a long straight, you want as much top line speed as possible. And that rear wing actually acts as a fundamental counterbalance because it actually slows you down. So from a regulations perspective, the sport likes that. They want to be able to regulate the top line speed of the cars, partly because of safety concerns, but also because they want to create parity. Now, the challenge is teams have always been able to find ways to create some degree of flex in their rear wings. And the controversy that erupted over the last week was, and we talked about this last week, was Lewis Hamilton spent a lot of the race chasing Max Verstappen. And he came out and announced, hey, that rear wing on the Red Bull looks awfully bendy.
Yeah.
And what he was referring to was that top speed in straight lines, the rear wing was almost collapsing. It was almost sinking a couple of inches lower than it should have been. And by dropping down, it reduces the amount of drag that's being felt by the car, enabling the car to go faster. Now, the sport effectively outlaws this. Bendy wings are a no-go, but the sport has been... they've really struggled to challenge and to control this for a long time because the reality is you can't build a wing or you can't enforce a regulation that forces teams to adopt wings that have no flex because under full load at top speed, if the wings couldn't flex a little bit, they would effectively shatter. So what you find are teams, especially Red Bull, always find ways to push the boundaries of the regulation of the sport. And effectively what happened last week was Red Bull was caught. So there's some tolerances allowed when it comes to the flex in the wings, but it looks like Red Bull had ultimately been able to find a way to apply greater flex to the wing at top speed, which reduced drag, which allows the cars to go faster. Now, none of this may make sense to you, but I'm going to post a video on our Twitter that I encourage you to check out. But ultimately, the crux of the story is Lewis is following Max. He sees the wing bending more than it probably should, which allows the car to go faster, which I think is super, super, super interesting. Now, I'm actually a big fan of the teams pushing the boundaries. Mm-hmm. Again, there's a difference between straight up cheating, which is what Ferrari did in 2019. There's a straight up difference between what Renault did way back in the mid 2000s with Crashgate. There's a big difference between what McLaren was potentially trying to do with Ferrari with stealing plans and things like that in the late 2000s. But ultimately, in terms of pushing the boundaries of the regulations, I'm all in. I think it's the responsibility of the FIA and Liberty and F1 to be able to manage the development of the cars and the teams better than they have historically. And we talked about this about a month ago, which is FIA is now going to start injecting inspectors into random teams at the end of each race to look for these kind of things. But ultimately, that's what the controversy was. Basically, in essence, they'd been able to develop a mini DRS solution without actually incorporating DRS.
Yeah, it really is interesting. And I think you raise a great point. And I don't condone cheating either, but I find it fascinating that, you know, the FIA, they lay down all these rules for Formula One. This is what you're allowed in terms of power units, aerodynamics, all these different areas that are very, very complex, very complicated, very difficult. And then, you know, you have to build a car within these parameters, right? But, you know, I don't see a problem with taking these rules and then interpreting them and finding a way to exploit them to your advantage legally.
Totally.
You know, but then, you know, it is funny, though, like then the question becomes, you know, where is that line drawn in the sand? When does exploiting the rules become outright gaining an unfair advantage? And I think that's when we see these technical directives and these clarifications that we saw a whole raft of them back in 2019 when it came to the things like, you know, burning oil and all these different, you know, around that whole Ferrari engine controversy. So it is interesting, too, because, you know, Christian Horner, Red Bull's team principal, he's basically saying our cars are scrutinized. They've been, you know, reviewed and examined, and, you know, they've been looked at 7 ways from Sunday by the FIA, and they passed, and the FIA is completely happy with the car. You know, I should mention that Ferrari said the exact same thing when it came to their power units in 2019. You know, so, you know, I'm not calling Christian Horner out, or I'm not you know, questioning his truthfulness, but I'm just drawing a parallel here that, you know, Ferrari, they did you know, ended up in this situation, and they, you know, everybody was calling them out. I mean, I think it's interesting this time that Lewis is basically saying that, you know, Max's rear wing was, you know, what he called bendy when it came to Ferrari and the issues that they were having. Max was the one that was calling them out and flat out calling them cheaters, you know.
Totally. So
it's kind of interesting too that it's flipped around, and it's also amazing that, you know, to hear this coming from Lewis, because, you know, I don't discount like his authenticity and, you know, his motives for saying so. Like, I don't think that he would fabricate something like this just to, you know, as some sort of mind games and to try to drag, you know, his opponents down into the muck. I mean, you know, I think he's a better person and a better sportsman than that. But, you know, the whole situation is fascinating because, you know, it's Lewis now following, you know, a rival. I mean, a couple of years ago, it just would have been so counterintuitive. You wouldn't expect it to come from somebody like that. But, you know, it's kind of funny too. It's just like, well, when I saw that comment and Lewis commenting about the bendy wings, I'm like, well, you know, who spent more time behind Max Verstappen's car over the, you know, not just this season, but previous seasons, is Valtteri Bottas, the other Mercedes driver, you know, and he didn't mention anything about bendy. So, I mean, I'm not saying that there's any sort of silver tinfoil hat conspiracy going on there, but it just kind of, you know, really popped into my mind. But I thought it was interesting too, because that was a story we talked about a couple of weeks ago, Super Spy Lewis, right? That, that one of the engineers that used to work for Mercedes just pointed out that, you know, that fine eye for detail that Lewis has and little weird things that he would pick up and commented on about, like, other teams are doing this and say, hey guys, they're doing that, you know, like, what are we doing about this, whatever that that issue might be. And I think that this you know, this whole bendy wing thing about the Red Bull, I think that's just another example of Lewis being Lewis and just having he's very astute and very good at picking up and observing details.
It's shocking that he was able to identify this, because I don't think we can truly appreciate how little these drivers can see when they're in the car. Not only are you slumped down in the car, you're wearing a visor, which is covered in dirt and debris and bugs. You're trying to look through a halo, and your car has fundamentally no suspension in terms of comfort. There's no cushioning in your seat, so you're vibrating along the racetrack. Yet he was able to identify that the car in front of him under full load had a rear wing that was slumping as much as an inch, maybe more. It's remarkable. And then, and again, I'll post it on Twitter. If you look at the video, it's totally there. It's clear as day that when under full load, under full suspension load, that wing sinks. And then when it breaks and the suspension load is released, the wing raises again. It's absolutely crazy. And again, the benefit to Red Bull here is that if your wing is bendy and it slumps, it reduces drag, which enables you to go faster. And just a comment on this as well, Hamilton believes that that bendy wing was giving them an advantage of as much as 0.3 seconds per lap, which may not be a lot, but that's a second every three laps. Like, it adds up very, very quickly, but absolutely remarkable that Lewis was able to spot that.
Yeah, absolutely. You know, I don't have anything to add to that because, like I said, I wanted to speed this along. I'm giving you 10 minutes now to go nuts on MotoGP Corner because you've been so patient about it. I know you're just bursting to bring us all up to speed on that.
You know, so I actually had a couple people reach out.
Oh, and look, the time's up. I'm sorry. The show's over.
I guess you're out of hard drive space.
Yeah, that's right. That's it. That's it. Out of hard drive space.
So if I'd known I had 10 minutes, I probably would have planned a little bit more. But I had some really, really great questions and some folks that actually reached out to me via DM and things like that. And they're just like, hey, if we're going to have to listen to this MotoGP thing, can you at least provide a little bit more context to the sport and the championship? So I'm going to try and do that a little bit today. I think the best way to talk about MotoGP is in the Formula One context. MotoGP is kind of like Formula One, but with motorcycles instead of open wheel racing cars. The structure of the championship is very similar. Just like Formula One, they race on premier global circuits across the planet. Now, in fact, there's a lot of overlap. So a lot of the tracks that the Formula One cars race on, the MotoGP bikes also race on. And oftentimes it's the exact same track configuration. So if you watch Formula One and you watch MotoGP, you can actually see the two different types of vehicles racing on the same track, on the same configuration, which is kind of cool. So this year, the MotoGP Championship has 19 races, which is about the norm. They typically, and I said this last year, the real base, the real foundation of the sport is in Spain, at least from a driver development perspective. They get kids starting on bikes as young as 3 or 4 years old, and then they take them through all the kind of the grassroots program. But in terms of the championship, there's a couple of drivers that I think are probably not necessarily transcendent, but probably worth understanding. The first rider that I would probably speak to today is a driver named Marc Márquez. He entered MotoGP in 2013. He won the MotoGP championship in 2013, 2014, 2016, 2017, 2018, and 2019. So in his short, well, probably not short history now, but in his history in MotoGP, he's already won 6 championships. And to put that into context, MotoGP is fundamentally different than Formula One when it comes to the demands of the driver. So the races are shorter. So a Formula One race is 1.5 hours, 45 minutes. A MotoGP race is probably closer to 40 or 45 minutes. And that's simply because the demands on the riders are exponentially higher than they are for Formula One drivers. And if you ever look at MotoGP highlights, it's not unusual over the course of the weekend, sometimes for these riders to fall off the bikes or take 2 or 3 crashes. And again, there's no chassis. There's no crumple zones around them to absorb that impact. It's literally the riders skidding across the tarmac, avoiding bikes, and sliding through the gravel trap. So it's a much more physically demanding sport. So there's really 2 driver or riders that are worth watching. One is Marc Márquez because he is absolutely the premium, absolute champion of the sport right now. And then the other is another rider named Valentino Rossi. And Valentino Rossi is very, very, very much at the end of his championship. He entered MotoGP in 2000. He's won 7 titles. He won a title in 01, 02, 03, 04, 05, 08, 09. He came within a hair of winning the 2015 championship, except for the fact that there was an incident between him and Marc Márquez at the penultimate event, the race before the final race. He's also worth watching, but at this point, his career is really, really winding down. But in terms of talent within the sport, the 2 big names are Marc Márquez. He's historically raced with Honda, and also Valentino Rossi, who's historically been associated with the Yamaha teams. Valentino Rossi is an incredible personality, incredibly charismatic. And just as we talk about Lewis being transcendent in the context of Formula One, Valentino has been transcendent to this sport in ways that I don't think it could ever have imagined a rider could have been. And I would encourage you, Google Valentino Rossi, take a look at his career, take a look at some of his racing wins on YouTube. He's very, very colorful. He's got a flamboyant personality. He's accessible. He's fun. He's jovial. Very, very cool. And then finally, from a team perspective, historically, the championship has been dominated by teams like Yamaha and Honda. Ducati, who is an Italian bike maker, has become much more competitive in recent years. And also some other Japanese manufacturers like Suzuki and ultimately some more European manufacturers like KTM and Aprilia have begun to become more relevant in the sport. But think about MotoGP as Formula One, but with bikes. Every team has two bikes. They have two riders. Very, very similar. And the structure of the championship is also very, very similar. So that's it for MotoGP this week. I'll give you a bit more of an update last week. But again, some folks had asked, just provide a little bit of context. If we have to sit through this gong show, there you go.
Hey, I'm actually kind of shocked that you didn't mention the obvious tie-up between MotoGP, Valentino Rossi, and Formula One, and the fact that Valentino did test for Ferrari, when was it, about 6-7 years ago? Longer?
Oh, I think it may have been about 2006. So
is it that Valentino long ago? Oh my gosh.
I'm so glad you brought this up. Valentino Rossi tested for Ferrari probably 10, 12, 15 years ago. The tests were incredibly successful, and it's understood he was very, very, very close to signing an agreement, not necessarily to race with Ferrari, because Ferrari was relatively stacked back then. Michael Schumacher was still a part of the team, and Raikkonen was around, and there were some other great drivers. But he had an opportunity to have pursued a Formula One career if he wanted it. It just would have been a challenging and risky move, given the fact that he was the current MotoGP champion, and the entire sport basically revolved around him at that perspective. But you're right, in terms of a talent, he could have raced in Formula One if that's something he wanted to pursue. Absolutely.
Cool. Hey, I just before we let everybody go, I just wanted to bring up something I thought this was really interesting. Like about a week ago, I sat down and I was looking at the stats. So where are people listening and watching the show from? And this absolutely kind of blew my mind. The one thing that I was already pretty aware of, that our top countries for listenership, over 50% of our listeners come from the USA. Then I think it's about 20-25% in Canada. No, actually, I think it's less than that. I think it's about 15%. In Canada, then the UK, Australia, New Zealand, and then a nice broad range of like everywhere else. I mean, the very strong downloads and listeners all over Europe. But you know, the one thing that absolutely was kind of interesting is I tried to boil down, and I literally spent minutes out of my life on this, is how dedicated I was. But I just went to sort the stats. So you want to know the number one location where we get the most listenership from is?
I want to know. I don't know, but I'm super eager to know now that you've got that data.
Well, it's New York City. New York City is the hotspot. All of the majority of our listeners, or the biggest percentage of our listeners, are in New York City, and I think that's kind of cool. I wish we had the rights to sign off the show with Frank Sinatra's "New York, New York," and I'm not going to torment everybody by my own pathetic rendition of that classic song. But excuse me. Regardless. Wherever you are, wherever you're listening or watching from, we appreciate it. And, I've got a million reasons why I want to visit the Big Apple. This is just one of those. I wouldn't say it's the deciding thing, but certainly it's one of the things that when I get the chance to, and hopefully it's going to be sooner rather than later, that it just makes that trip to New York a little bit more enjoyable.
I appreciate the 30 seconds you spent mining that data. That was fantastic. And while time well you're asking spent. Me questions, and I know we've got to sign off here because we're clicking in at hour number four, but I found a really interesting post on Reddit, and I apologize, I don't have the original poster's name, but somebody on Reddit had actually gone and done a really cool analysis of the inventory and pricing of all of the merchandise on the F1 team stores to get a sense of like how many items, what's the average price, et cetera, et cetera. Now, you and I know, and if you don't know as a listener, F1 merchandise is notoriously expensive.
Basically,
it's atrociously expensive.
I think it's basically, you think, take whatever you think the item is that you want, you've come out with a price what you think it's worth, double it, and then add some horrendous cost on top of it to ship it.
Totally. Oh my God. And then customs and duty when it gets to North America, because it's typically worse. Chinese made shipping out of Europe. So we get hammered with customs. So yeah. an $80 t-shirt typically becomes $220. If you're going to buy F1 merch, it's cheaper to buy tickets to a race and buy it at the track than it is to order it online. So here's a question for you. So they did this fantastic analysis. So from the average price perspective, the average price of all the merchandise on the team stores, which team do you think has the most expensive merchandise?
Ferrari.
Ferrari is third cheapest at $69 US.
Wow.
So I'm going to run you through this because this is shocking. The cheapest is Red Bull at $63, followed by Mercedes at $68. Mm-hmm. Again, pretty shocking given the fact that Mercedes is one of the most dominant teams and probably has a ton of demand for merch, followed by Ferrari at $69, McLaren at $69, Alpine at $91, so pretty expensive. AlphaTauri, $93 on average to buy AlphaTauri merchandise. Aston Martin at $113, which you and I both know because that was the first thing we checked out and then we closed the website disappointingly.
Yeah, just as fast as I opened it.
Williams has the most expensive merchandise in the sport. The average ticket price for a piece of Williams merch on the website is $120 US.
Wow. Wow.
On that note, oh my gosh.
Yeah, on that note, I don't have my wallet, my Visa here anyways, but certainly I will not be perusing the Williams team store anytime soon based on that shocking report. But interesting that somebody put that all together. And on that note, I think that's about everything that we got. Thank you all very much for downloading and listening to the show. Thank you for your emails, the tweets, the comments, everything. We appreciate it a lot. And, well, unfortunately, no race this weekend, so we won't be back on Sunday night, but we'll be back next week. And again, if you guys want to, instead of mailbag, if you want to record a short voice message for inclusion in the mailbag, we'll play off some of those. We can do that eventually if we get the website up and running again. We'll find a little bit of a slicker way to do it. But if you want to record a voice memo, email it to us at scuderiaf1pod@gmail.com or tweet us at scuderiaf1pod. And on behalf of myself and Mark Hamilton, have a great weekend and we'll talk to you guys again very, very soon. Bye for now.